Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Florida's coronavirus cases continue to trend upwards as the state has become a new hotspot for the virus. Florida has added tens of thousands of cases over the past week, bringing the total to now more than 156,000. Now, this comes as former hotspots like New York have seen a decline in new COVID cases in recent weeks. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Governor Ron DeSantis have been at odds with each other since the start of the pandemic and have taken drastically different approaches. New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei recently explored those differing responses, and she joins us now. Patty, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been following Florida's coronavirus numbers for months now. When did you start to notice the trends shifting in Florida becoming worse, now becoming what we are today?
The number of new cases per day appears to start having gone up in early June. So it took a couple of weeks to really see the trend in full force, but that was about the time when the second phase of reopening began in most parts of the state, generally excluding Miami-Dade and Broward counties.
So with your conversations with the public health experts in the state, and the Florida Department of Health, I mean, we can link the spike to the state's reopening?
The governor has not really made that link decisively. His argument has been the reopening began in early May, and the number of cases did not start going up in early May. But the secretary for the Department of Business and Professional Regulation, who last week was the one who announced that there would be no drinking at bars anymore in the counties that had bars reopened, he did make that connection. He said that the spikes began after phase two, and that would coincide with early June. The things that started opening in the second phase were more conducive, it looks like, from our reporting, to the socialization that the governor and other state officials have blamed for this. So bars being the top example, perhaps, of people getting together closer to each other in bigger groups. And of course, if they're drinking, perhaps also after a while, not really paying as much attention to things like social distancing.
So we've seen the numbers go up, but something else has changed too, which is the profile of the typical patient. How has that changed?
They are younger now, and that difference is stark. In March, there was not a lot of testing, right? And most of the people getting tested were people who had symptoms or were already sick. The median age in Florida for a positive coronavirus case was 65 years old. That number now is hovering around 35 years old and has been as low as 33 years old on some days when we have looked. So what that means is that we are seeing the virus spread in the community among younger people who maybe are out more, maybe are trying to go back to work and need to get tested. In many cases, these people are asymptomatic and didn't even know that they were sick. But if they're transmitting the virus, then the concern is that they will spread it to older people or more at-risk populations.
Let's take a look at how New York and Florida approached the pandemic from the beginning. Let's go back to April, and this is when the virus is at its peak in New York. What was Governor DeSantis' argument for shutting down travel from the Empire State to the Sunshine State?
DeSantis was among the first people to argue that New Yorkers were seeding the virus in other parts of the country, that they were fleeing the city because the cases were so bad there and going to either rental homes or family homes or, you know, vacation homes, including in South Florida, because New York and Florida just have longstanding business and family and personal ties. At first, New Yorkers, I would say some of them took offense to that, the idea that they were, you know, taking the virus out and infecting people outside of their state. But over time, we did see data that showed that a lot of New Yorkers, in fact, spread the virus to not just Florida, but other parts of the country as well. So his argument was, if those people are going to come here, and we know that they're coming here because we're seeing full flights arrive in Miami International Airport, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, then those people are going to have to sign a form that says that they are going to isolate themselves for 2 weeks once they arrive.
What can you tell us are the fundamental differences between Governor Cuomo's and Governor DeSantis's, approach to the pandemic?
Well, we've done a lot of reporting in the New York Times, my colleagues in New York, about the things that Governor Cuomo got wrong early on in the pandemic. But after some of those early missteps, they began really heeding the advice of the public health experts, including, for example, mandating masks in April and, beefing up their contact tracing operation to the point where per person, they have a lot more contact tracing there right now than we do. They also shut down more in general. For example, they shut down construction sites, which we never shut down statewide, and they have reopened different parts of the economy more slowly than Florida has.
You said it a little while ago, too. I mean, these two states have a very unique relationship and a long history. I mean, you got snowbirds coming down from New York. A lot of people moved to South Florida from New York. But during this pandemic, how are the attitudes between New Yorkers and Floridians shifted and changed? What have you seen?
Well, there's a lot of sort of blame going back and forth, chiefly among the politicians, of course, which reflects, Governor Cuomo's a Democrat, Governor DeSantis is a Republican, Governor DeSantis is friendly with the president, Governor Cuomo not so much. But also just with people going back and forth, they've been trying to flee to go to the safest place. And so one of my colleagues spoke to a gentleman from White Plains, New York, who had come to Boca in March and was leaving before New York quarantined Floridians because he was going to feel safer in New York. Now, I wanted to go back to your earlier question about the different policies in the two states, because one of the important ones that I should mention is on nursing homes. 6,200 people died in nursing homes in New York, and that has been attributed in part to the fact that the governor let coronavirus patients returning to nursing homes while they were still sick and they infected other people. That's something Florida has not allowed. It's been sort of a big point of contention on the Florida side. Like, well, you guys claim we're terrible, but your numbers are, so much worse because you failed to do that. I think the question is just different now because Florida's cases are going up, as you noted at the start of the show. And when you see one state sort of doing dramatically better and the other one starting to worsen, we use the word schadenfreude in the story, but it's true. There's just sort of this, pointing fingers at the state that's in the worst misfortune right now. And honestly, this thing could go on for so long. It just seems a little short-sighted, to be having this war of words back and forth.
Yeah. And Governor DeSantis, this goes to something you said a moment ago as well. Governor DeSantis has repeatedly stated he has no plans to roll back. And yet on Friday, the state placed these restrictions on the sale of alcohol in bars. Do we have any indications from individuals within the administration that if this gets worse, there could be rollbacks, that it's even on the table for him?
We don't. He has not said he's going to do that, and sort of backed himself into a corner by defending all the steps that have already been taken. It was notable that on Friday, when the Department of Business and Professional Regulation banned drinking at bars, it was announced in a tweet by that department and then followed up with an executive order by that department. The governor had a press conference that afternoon and did not bring this change up until he was asked about it. So he did not seem very keen on talking about it. He has continued to maintain he's not going to mandate masks. He thinks that he supports local communities who want to do so, but that he's not going to do that statewide because he says the virus is different in different parts of the state. And there has just not been any new policy prescription articulated statewide on behalf of the governor at this point.
I'm talking with New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei, based here in Miami. New York recently announced a 14-day self-quarantine period for travelers from Florida as the virus continues to spread here in the state of Florida. You can hear or find more of her recent stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to shift over to this other story from the governor. DeSantis has claimed that migrant workers in Florida's agriculture communities are the number one cause of spread of the virus. Do we have a sense of just how much the virus is spreading in those areas relative to what we see in the urban regions?
Well, I think, first of all, that claim has sort of shifted in the past week or so when they really realized that it's younger people everywhere. You know, I think for about maybe a period of a week, they were saying it was really just the high-risk communities in among migrant workers or farm workers, among nursing home residents and prisoners where the virus was spiking. And then they eventually had to acknowledge that it was beyond that, that it was community spread among young people. But the problem in farm towns was real. And it was largely because they are essential workers who are not able to stay home. Even if they get sick and are told to stay home, these are people who often can't afford to not work, to especially to miss 2 weeks of work. And they tend to work in very close quarters, all of them huddled around a tomato plant, for example, and to live with either large extended families or other workers. So it was a combination of all of those factors that contributed to just a lot of infections there. We saw big numbers, relatively speaking, for their populations in Immokalee. We saw that happening in several communities in Palm Beach County, Belle Glade, Indian Town, and Martin County. So you could see the problem sort of spreading north as the migrant workers and the harvest moved north too, because as it gets warmer, you know, the harvest moves further up the eastern seaboard.
Well, and two parts here that let me start with this. I mean, first of all, what's the testing like in those communities, like Immokalee, Belle Glade, Clewiston? What, I mean, do they have, extensive testing going on?
I was in Immokalee a couple of weeks ago, and they were doing testing almost every day or every day between the health department and clinics and local organizations. But that was not the case early on. In fact, the state did not do its big mass testing operation. Its first one took place in early May, and workers groups had been demanding more testing since March. So it took a long time for the sort of official state operations to realize that they needed to get mass testing to these places. By then, you know, Doctors Without Borders was in Immokalee because they realized they didn't have a hospital and that they were going to need a lot of care. So the contention of the people who live there is that the testing took a long time to arrive, and only once it did it prove what they knew, which was there was a problem. There was a lot of spread.
And the other thing too is in these communities, is the information campaign working the same way as you see in cities? Are migrant workers, are these workers getting the information, understanding, everything that we are understanding about masks, social distancing, and everything else?
That was one of the challenges because, first of all, a large, I don't know the number, but a significant population of migrant workers is undocumented, and not really super trustworthy of the authorities for various reasons, and not eager to go talk to, you know, the health department. But in addition to that, even the folks who are here with papers, it's a language barrier. They have to use the local radio stations to, for example, disseminate information not just in Spanish, but also in Haitian Creole and in indigenous languages. So in Mam, which is a Mayan dialect, for example. And so there is a language barrier. There's the fact that they're working all day. It's not like they have time to be reading up on this. There was a distrust of the authorities, and just a lack of personnel to really go out into the communities and it tell people that, you know, you have to wear a mask, you have to wash your hands. It's not enough to take a shower after you get back from work, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you mentioned it too. They only have a clinic in Immokalee. And back in April, we talked with Gerardo Reyes Chavez. He's one of the leaders of the Coalition for Immokalee Workers. And he argued why workers have called on the governor for a field hospital. This is what he said.
There is no way in which people can, effectively isolate themselves. You live with 10 to 12 other people. Sometimes you don't even know these people. Who's gonna be taking care of you, and where are you going to isolate if you live with three or four other guys, or if you live with your family? There's sometimes two, three families. How are you supposed to isolate to protect your loved ones from contagion? You can't.
So they have a clinic. I mean, what kind of health care do they have there beyond that? What does that provide them?
To get to a hospital, they have to basically go 45 minutes away. And it's part of why it's been really hard to have good statistics on deaths in Immokalee, because if they pass away at a hospital, the hospital is not local. Sometimes those people have to be sent to hospitals even further away for more acute treatment, like in Orlando. So that's a problem. The other problem is the isolation that the gentleman was talking about. They had rooms, hotel rooms for people to isolate in Collier County in Naples. Well, that's 45 minutes away from Immokalee. A lot of people don't drive, and so they were not comfortable going there, so they finally had to like rent places for people to isolate themselves in Immokalee. And then if they got really sick, other than going to the clinic or trying to talk to Doctors Without Borders while they were there, it was a real challenge. I mean, I spoke to a woman who's a housekeeper at a country club who was sick, and she said she didn't see a doctor the entire time. She tested positive for the coronavirus. She felt terrible. She had fevers and headaches and was vomiting and lost a lot of weight. But she just stayed home. She drank tea and soup and Tylenol, and she made it through that way. But she said she would have liked to go to a doctor, but she just didn't sort of nowhere to go, and had read that there was no treatment, and so she sort of just did it herself. But it's a gamble. It's risky.
And again, as a point that, obviously our harvest season here in Florida is over. A lot of these workers now moved on through Georgia, the Carolinas, up into Michigan. They'll be back again in November. As you continue following the pandemic through Florida, what are the trends? What are the stories that you're keeping an eye on? What's next?
Well, we are trying to get a grasp on what the issue is with hospitalizations. The state has information through the Agency for Healthcare Administration on the percentage of hospital beds available in a county or hospital at any given time, but doesn't actually track in any way that we can access the numbers going up or down. It's sort of in real time, but not helpful to compare and see like hospitalizations going up or down, other than like in Miami-Dade County, where we have the data at the county level. So that's been difficult. You have to call a bunch of hospitals and find out how they're doing. I think we also see local governments, in addition to requiring masks, trying to take other steps. In Miami-Dade County, they're sending teams of county employees to go to some of these hotspots and knock on doors and give people masks and hand sanitizer and information. It's not contact tracing, it's just sort of basic public health education effort. And we'll see if that's enough. I mean, it sounds to me like the local officials are trying to figure out what else they can do short of locking down again, which was so difficult for the economy. And I haven't heard anybody say that's what they want. But I don't know what the alternative option is if the hospitalizations increase and we start seeing those numbers worsen.
A lot of us don't know what's coming next. We're just wait and see and hope. Again, talking with New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei, based here in Miami. You can find more of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Patty, it's always a pleasure. Stay safe.
Thanks, you too.
Well, still to come, last call comes early for Florida bars. How are restaurants and pubs surviving the pandemic? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Last call at bars across Florida came early and unexpectedly. On Friday, just before noon, the state issued an order suspending alcohol consumption at all bars in response to the surge of coronavirus cases. Miami-Dade County followed with an order to cut off all establishments from selling alcohol after midnight. Over the weekend, Fort Lauderdale shut down at least 9 restaurants for violating those rules. The Miami Herald reports that some restaurants are voluntarily closing their dining rooms because they say that operating at this time isn't worth the investment or the risk. We've assembled a group of people from the industry to help talk about this topic. First up, I have Ryan Dickey. He's an operations manager at General Horseplay. That's a bar in Key West. Ryan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as well.
Also joining us is Annie Mainhold, co-owner of the restaurant Fukia in Miami. Annie, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Jeff Lubkuman is the senior vice president of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Jeff, I appreciate you. Thank you for being with us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And I just want to mention that we'd love to hear from our listeners. If you've been out to restaurants or maybe you work in the industry, tell us what you see, what's going on. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Okay, so folks, the emergency order on Friday bans all bars from serving alcohol on site. The news was released on a tweet before the order was even posted on the website. Jeff, I'll start with you. What response did you receive from your members? I mean, was there any confusion?
Confusion and quick reaction are the orders of the day throughout this event. We have been very grateful to the governor and all the executive agencies, public health officials that have worked with us to try and allow some sort of economic activity to continue to occur. Frankly, we were not surprised all that deeply by the announcement that was made Friday. There were whenever these things happen, I live in Tallahassee and I work in and around the government process, so I'm very familiar with how things work, how to parse executive orders. But folks like my colleagues that are on the panel today don't deal with executive orders and legal language on a daily basis. So we got a lot of calls asking what exactly does this mean, and that's one of the benefits of a trade association. That's what the Florida Restaurant Lodging Association does on a regular basis, perform that kind of service to help people understand obligations and,
Jeff,
and changes.
And Jeff, I mean, do you think it's fair?
You know, the word fair in this particular event is not really relevant. This is a public health event, and we have to respect the science first, and we have to protect patrons and staff first. So, you know, we could cry unfair all day long about things, but it doesn't change the science of a disease pandemic. So we're supportive of public health decisions that ultimately will allow us to return to normalcy.
Yeah. Ryan, you work at a bar. Tell me how you heard the news and how is it affecting you?
Well, it's once again just flipped the script on us for what the umpteenth time so far in the last few months. My main job involves all our music and events and logistics and everything behind that sort of thing. And in addition to standard operations, we're a craft cocktail bar that also has a live music venue attached to it. So I was actually coordinating with the musicians I had scheduled for the private party that evening to figure out sound check and whatnot. Just had not got off the phone with one of them, and my phone starts blowing up. I'm like, uh-oh, who died? Right? And we're all basically trying to figure out, is this fake news? Because we couldn't, you know, it wasn't like it was, you know, a concisive. It was just like you said, it was initially announced through a tweet, which, you know, that's inconvenient. And then, as Jeff alluded to, the order was basically clear as mud, because we're sitting here trying to figure out, okay, what can we, are we allowed to? Yes, no, we can, you know, we're down here in Key West. So the ability to do, you know, roadie drinks is, you know, something, okay, well, we can adapt and overcome. But even then, we're hit with all day trying to figure out, okay, what is the actual legality of what we're trying to do? Now, this is on top of having to do months of various preparations and actions for COVID and trying to have best practices and basically completely reimagining, you know, the business model in many ways.
Right.
Not only, you know, how do we provide service, but how do we make money at the same time? So throwing this again on top of it is just, all right, here we go again.
A lot of regulations in place right now to be able to operate. Annie, has your restaurant been affected by this order?
The no alcohol bar part of it, no, because we're licensed as a restaurant and most of our sales come for food. So we have a 70-30 split food to liquor. So it does not affect us. But for sure, the reopening phase and the increase in cases has definitely stalled our business. You know, the increase in cases has kept people from coming out. And, you know, when you're already operating at 50% of your capacity, combining people being afraid to go out, combining people not showing up for reservations made through your reservation system and our location, it feels like the stack is just against us.
Yeah, this is what we're hearing from a lot of people. Jeff, last week you issued updated safety guidelines for the service industry during this time. What updates did you include and why?
Well, again, the space space that we operate in, we're very accustomed to dealing with public health agencies and food safety regulations, things that are kind of techno-speak and a lot of legalese involved. So one of the benefits that we provide as a trade association and a service we provide our members is trying to put that into operating terms and executable language. What is it? What does all this legalese mean to the person running shift by shift in a food service establishment? So the guidelines that we've put out mirror the CDC's guidelines, also material developed in coordination with the National Restaurant Association and also the American Hotel and Lodging Association. And there's not a lot of great ahas in there. What it comes down to is really the term that I've been hammering is active managerial control.
So you know what, Jeff, if I may, let's take an example. Let's say within an establishment, one of the workers comes down with COVID. What then? What happens?
One size does not fit all in that circumstance. The first thing to do is to discuss what should be done with that business's risk managers, contacting their general liability carrier, as well as anybody that gives them legal advice. There is a slate of things on the CDC website that have been well publicized at this point in terms of deep cleaning, sanitizing, closing areas, and then making sure staff know that there's been a positive test case in that establishment, and then the contact tracing starts and testing other employees starts. Should the business close or not, it really depends on the type of business, the volume of business, and the size of the staff and how extensive the contact was with that person that's now been diagnosed as positive, which is why one size does not fit all. We recommend really formulating strategy with the people most familiar with the risk management strategy for that business.
Yeah. Ryan and Annie, I want to ask you, because you really have to take on a very different role now in these times. You have to police the guests. You want to make sure they're having a good time because you want them to come back and you want the business. But again, you have to be compliant with the new guidelines. Annie, I'll start with you. How are you managing that? Or are you not having any trouble with that at all?
I think, we've done several things to upgrade our space in order to manage the situation. Our space originally had two entrances, so we have closed one of the entrances and created one central entrance so that at any point in time that a guest comes in, we've always got someone of a leadership position at the door, sort of setting the tone for the experience. Good evening. Ascertaining the reservation, taking some guest information down, offering sanitizer, explaining to them that they have to have their mask on at all time unless they're seated at their table. And then like someone else walks them to a table and proceeds to show them where the restrooms are, sanitation stations are. And then finally, once they're seated at the table that's already been sanitized, we also give them an antiseptic cloth. So from the very first 5 minutes of being within our establishment, it's like sanitation, sanitation, sanitation. And yes, there have been people that just walk in without a mask. And we ask them, would you mind please putting on a mask? And sometimes they get fussy and sometimes they don't. But at the same time, we've also gone out of our way to place ample signage for social distancing on the floor. We've got signage on all doors that have have masks on them. So we've really set the tone for that kind of for those protocols.
And Annie, Miami-Dade says they have police conducting regular service checks of restaurants and bars. Have you seen officers come by? And if you have, what are they doing?
I have not seen it at my restaurant. Again, I have my restaurants in a sleepy neighborhood, so I'm very much a destination restaurant. But I've seen it around busier places. I wish I would see more of it, to be honest with you. I think that people and businesses should be policed. Call me crazy, but instead of having meter maids, I don't think you should be charging for street parking because no one's out. Take the meter maid, take that effort, take those employees, have them start actually ticketing people. I think we need to start policing the public so that everyone falls in line, because the longer we're all on a different page, the longer it'll take us to get out of this economic crisis that we're in, because it's not just public safety, it's an economic crisis as well.
Ryan, what about you? Are people following the guidelines? Are they doing what we asked them to do? What's your experience like?
So as far as the other businesses here in town, most of them have been doing a very good job of trying to comply with regulations and this and that to the best of our ability. We've gone way out of our way at Horseplay, many of the things that she mentioned. But you can imagine we're in Key West. We're just off Duval Street. It basically welcomed a Thunderdome down here. it is the exact opposite, where, you know, we're burning out door guys left and right, you know, where they're having to play police. And that's, the locals have been pretty good about things, but let's be real. You know, drunk people are like small children, you know, after a certain amount of time. And it's like, don't climb on that. All of that. So now we're having to police them on keeping a mask on anytime they're not seated. And, you know, we've gone out of our way as an establishment to completely rethink our seating and our configuration, not to mention that effectively the business model, as she alluded to, decreased capacity, and you're having to have increased staff in the form of security and everything else. And so here in Key West, we've got people coming from all over the country and, you know, all over the world. And it's honestly, it's a mixed bag.
My friends
are getting really burnt out on things.
Yeah, and you recently posted a public service announcement on your Facebook page where you said, sometimes you have to be a bit of a jerk, but it's out of love, right?
I was using a little bit more colorful language than that, and also 5 in the morning, let's be honest, I had a few at that point. It had been that kind of evening. But again, if you're trying to do this the right way, and especially in a busy party town like Key West, I mean, and then dovetail on top of it that many of the establishments, the equivalent establishments up the road in South Florida are still closed. Everybody and their grandmother has thought, all right, cool, let's come down and take over Key West. And they're not coming in with realistic expectations. They think it's going to be party central. And it is to a degree, but many places are still closed. There's limited capacity. You have to wait in the line. Yes, you're going to have to wear a mask. You have to keep wearing that mask. No, I don't care if you don't do that where you're from. You have to keep wearing that mask. And it's not our choice. Do we agree with it or not? That's not up for debate. You know, these are the rules that we have to comply by. So please stop making our jobs more difficult. We have to wear the mask for 12 hours straight. We're only asking you to wearing it when you're standing up, walking, going to the bathroom, and then coming back. Not really that difficult.
I will tell you, Ryan, I feel for you. I spent a lot of time in the food service industry. I can't imagine having to deal with those customers at this point. It's got to be tricky. Again, we're talking with a panel about the balancing act of running a restaurant or bar during a pandemic. We got to keep everybody safe. We're talking with Jeff Lubcomen. He's the Senior Vice President of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Annie Mainhold is the co-owner of the restaurant Fukia in Miami. And Ryan Dickey is the Operations Manager at General Horseplay. That's a bar in Key West. And by the way, again, we want to hear from you. If you're going out to restaurants, you work in one, tell us what you see. What's going on? Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know. Jeff, we're hearing, again, enforcement of these guidelines. It's challenging in some places, as Ryan is sitting here telling us. What are your thoughts on how these new measures should be enforced, how enforcement should work?
Yeah, and I'll mirror what Ryan and Annie said. We welcome the enforcement. Usually a trade association's job is to keep the government out of our businesses and make it easier for us to operate. But we all have a really clear understanding that the sooner that we fully adopt these public health interventions, the sooner that we can put this behind us and tackle the economic leg of this catastrophe. So, yeah, we fully support, first and foremost, orders that are clear and understandable that we can execute in our businesses. And then, yes, fair and even-handed enforcement across the board.
Jeff,
if we have responsible operators like Ryan and Annie doing the best to control circumstances in their restaurant, but the place up the street is wide open, wild, wild west, we know that that place is going to get the attention of public policymakers and result in more orders that are not going to be good for any of us.
And Jeff,
my hat's off to Annie and Ryan for doing the right thing and just imploring everybody in the industry, politics aside and the divisiveness of the day aside, this is a public health event, first and foremost, based in science, which is pretty clear and undebatable. So we certainly, FLA supports enforcement that's going to keep the public safe and let us get to an economic recovery sooner rather than later.
And you know what? I wanted to just jump in. Annie and Ryan, ask you this question. We've seen now pressures coming from social media, not from law enforcement, not from the government, just people who are going around. There's an Instagram account in Miami that's shaming restaurants that don't follow the guidelines and posting this up. Annie, I don't know if that's happened to you, but what do you think about that idea that people now are going around shaming others for not following guidelines?
You know, I think shame on them. I feel very passionately about this. This gentleman or this female, COVID_305, they actually had to take down their account. They were being presented with death threats. Their friends were being threatened as well. And I went to go message them yesterday, just because, you know, we had a really nice relationship. I have no idea who this person is. I actually don't know if it's a man or a woman either. And they took the account down. And now I have no way of getting a hold of them, because I don't know if they took it down because they're afraid or because Instagram took it down. Although if Facebook and Instagram feels that they're obligated to protect the First Amendment by, you know, putting out white supremacist imagery, but yet imagery of them holding irresponsible businesses and irresponsible citizens of Miami accountable for their irresponsibility is offensive. I mean, I don't know which one is worse, really. I mean, I do know which one is worse, but honestly, like, the account's gone now. Shame on those people. Shame on those people for bullying someone into doing the right thing. And now, because they tried to retain their anonymity, I can't find those individuals, and I don't even know if they're okay, because I know for a fact that they were being presented with death threats.
Yeah. Ryan, I mean, I'd like your take on this too, but also I wonder if, you know, the locals, because as you said, you don't have trouble with locals. It's outsiders. If locals are shaming or even, you know, getting into tourists' faces like, hey, you know, we're all wearing the mask. We're all trying to be safe. You got to, you know, play along.
It's a mixed bag on that front. You also have some locals that, you know, don't want anything to do with it. And I get it. You know, that's a different debate for a different time. Another the thing we have down here is, we've got the social media pressure, but we've got the Coconut Telegraph, and that is stronger and wider and more dangerous and more powerful than any of that. So the rumor mill that we have in the local community and things like that, that's our first and foremost, you know. Then we also use social media like crazy, but that hasn't been, you know, as much of an issue. The thing that's really popped up, especially in the last few days, has been the fact with the bars all shutting down. Yeah, it's a boon for the restaurants, but they're overwhelmed now. So you have a bunch of party people in town, and the only place to get a drink is at the quote-unquote restaurant, right? So now my friends who work at these restaurants, their heads are spinning around in circles. And, you know, if everybody is now being shoved into a few different locations, How is that any better? You know, responsibly spread across versus shoving people into one of a few locations, that's not exactly the smart way of doing things.
Jeff, I'm going to turn to you, finish up here real briefly. I mean, what are you hearing from your members about their business, how it's financially, how all this is affecting them? Can they survive?
That is a question that'll be really we'll start to answer in the third quarter of this year. With the several phases of government relief programs that we saw earlier in the event, and anticipating a fourth leg to that sometime late in July, those are bridge measures. But really, the disease is going to direct the economic activity. So, we're hearing catastrophic news from the industry. The National Restaurant Association is forecasting somewhere on the order of 20% to 30%. Of restaurants in the U.S. will not reopen after this. So that's an economic crisis of a magnitude none of us have lived through.
Yeah.
And so we're holding our breath.
Yeah. Jeff Lubcomen is the Senior Vice President of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, Annie Mainhold, co-owner of the restaurant Fukia in Miami, and Ryan Dickey, Operations Manager at General Horseplay, a bar in Key West. Jeff, Annie, Ryan, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and the best to you as you move forward.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate you.
Thank you.
If I can say something, if you guys do go out, please treat your servers well. Please comply. Just make everybody's life easy. And, you know, we're all stuck in this together. So, you know, it's not the fault of the workers that they're having to, you know, comply with some rules that you may not agree with.
Excellent. Hey, last words.
Good job.
Thank you so much. And, you know, we did hear from some of our listeners. Megan Koch in Twitter says, my family owns Tommaso's in Boca. We have not reopened the dining room. Still only curbside takeout and delivery. Only employees inside doing what we can to protect us, our staff, the families. It has been incredibly stressful. For the most part, customers are great. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Well, still to come, Major League Soccer kicks off the season with a tournament in Orlando. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, fans in South Florida will finally be able to see their Inter-Miami team play. It's tomorrow night on ESPN. Sports trying to come back during this pandemic. Major League Soccer, one of the first to get back. There are 26 teams in Orlando this week. They're playing a tournament. This, again, to try to kickstart the MLS season again. It's going to be at the ESPN Wide World of Sports Complex. Already 20 MLS players, though, and six staffers have tested positive for the virus. Last week, we spoke with the Miami Herald's reporter, Michelle Coffin, about what fans can expect this season now that the league is restarting but trying to keep players safe.
Yeah, MLS decided they really wanted to be the first league out there. This is a great opportunity for MLS, assuming that everybody stays healthy. This is a great opportunity for MLS with baseball not starting yet. MLS can be center stage starting on July 8th. The MLS will be playing actual meaningful games. They count toward their standings. And so they really wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to start playing as soon as they could safely. So they decided to have a World Cup style tournament in Orlando at the ESPN Wide World of Sports. All 26 teams, just like the NBA is doing, all 26 teams will be sequestered at the Swan and Dolphin Resort in Orlando. They will then ride their own buses over to the ESPN Wide World of Sports. They will play all of their matches there with no fans. And it will be a World Cup style tournament. So there will be a group round with three games. And then the top 16 teams go on to the knockout round. And the tournament goes on from July 8th until August 11th.
They wanted to get their season started before anybody else. They've been practicing, right? They've been preparing for this.
Yes, they have. They actually they started pretty early with individual workouts the players were allowed to go to the team training facility and do individual workouts. It was very careful. They were tested as they came into the parking lot. They had their temperature tested. Then they parked. You know, even the parking lot had three spaces in between each car. Each player had one quarter of a field. So there were four players on a field at one time in quadrants, and they just practiced by themselves, shooting, dribbling, running. After that, it progressed to small group training, which was six players on half a field. And they did that for a while. And then on June 9th, they began full team training. And they are, in order to do full team training, they had to have testing, COVID testing, every 48 hours.
We know that this works because European leagues have been playing now for some time, but what did we learn from them? I mean, what is it like for them? Because obviously they're playing in empty stadiums. They can't celebrate like they used to. There are a lot of restrictions, but basically are we just doing what they're doing? How's it worked for them?
The American leagues in general, not just MLS, but NBA, you know, NFL, I'm sure, is watching baseball. Everyone is watching European soccer because they are the first one that came back. The Bundesliga in Germany was the very first big league in Europe to come back. And, you know, their protocol booklet, or really was like a novel, I think it was like 200 pages of rules for Bundesliga. And yes, it involves everything, and the MLS one does also, everything from no jersey swapping. You know, a lot of the traditions of soccer are going to be missing. They're not allowed to swap jerseys. There's no high fives. The celebrations have to be very muted. They're not allowed to kiss the ball. You know, different things. No spitting. If you do spit, you have to go spit way on the side of the field where nobody is. So, you know, there's going to be there. It's definitely going to look different as far as the fans and what it's going to look and sound like on TV. The European leagues have been very creative, and MLS has not announced yet exactly what they're doing, but they definitely have been, you know, taking notes of what they're doing in Europe. And in the Bundesliga, there are teams who have been using cardboard cutouts. That's also been going on, I think, in Australia and in Korea, cardboard cutouts of fans.
This is a strange new world we're living in. But here's a, coming back to this idea, too, because we hear this in all the sports, right, that they have to create a bubble for the players and the team. So you had mentioned it. There are going to be very strict rules about the living situation with the players and teams. Is there any fear, though, of enforcement? Because, you know, asking athletes, you know, to basically sequester themselves into a small space for a long time, and I don't know, will they have family? Will they allow family or friends? I mean, what's that life going to be like for them?
They are not allowing family or friends in MLS. I know that in NBA they are. NBA is a longer stretch. I think NBA, if you go all the way to the finals, they're talking about being 3 months sequestered in Orlando. This one, the players' union negotiated. It was actually a long, drawn-out negotiation. The players did not want to be there. It was initially going to be 2 months. The players resisted and said no. They did not want to be gone from their families that long. So they made it, it can be a maximum of 35 days. And then teams like Inter Miami, if your team is in a city that is allowing a full team practices, and if your team is willing to do the testing every 48 hours, then the teams are allowed to arrive in Orlando 7 days before their first game, their game. And yeah, asking any young person to sequester themselves for that long and not go out into the public is going to be very difficult to enforce. They claim that, you know, they think they're going to be able to enforce it. They say that they're going to have activities for them on the Disney grounds, like they can play golf, they can play tennis, they can go in the swimming pool, they can go on the running track, they can go in the gym. They're going to have, you know, all kinds of like games and things brought in and make like big game rooms and stuff where they can play billiards and they can do video games on big screens and, you know, all kinds of, they're trying to create basically like camp, like summer camp for the entire, you know, but we're talking about over 700 players. You're talking about 700 players. You're asking them to be 4 or 5 weeks in a hotel resort without ever leaving the grounds. That's going to be difficult. Nobody's allowed, as far as media, even like me, I'm the beat writer for Inter Miami. I will have no access to players or team, nor have I so far.
What is the plan if, you know, a lot of players all of a sudden come down with it? Because, you know, even with this bubble, I mean, we're seeing this in a lot of sports. A lot of players are being diagnosed. Are they ready to shut it all down if that's the case?
They haven't said that. You know, we've asked that, and they really, I'm sure they have a plan in place. They haven't said because they don't expect that to happen. That's basically their view is that this is, it's going to be safe. If there are any cases, they will sequester those players, take them out, quarantine them. They feel that they will be able to get this tournament in safely because they're all going to be in the bubble. They firmly believe that the players, you know, the players are signing a contract that they are going to follow all these rules. Every single player has to sign a, you know, contract saying they're going to do this. So they are trusting their players to do the right thing. And, you know, time will tell.
Have you heard anything from Major League Soccer? Because you have the NBA who, that also wants to play in Orlando. But Florida is one of the three states where the numbers are rising very quickly. Have you heard from Major League Soccer their concern about bringing it here to a state where you see these numbers climbing so fast?
I've asked them that, and they said no, that they do see the numbers. They see the numbers. They know the numbers. They still believe that they're going to be safe. They're going to be inside their bubble. The numbers are very big, but the population of this state is also 22.7 million. It's not that the sports leagues are just sitting around making these decisions on their own, saying, ooh, we need to make some money. Yes, they do need to make money. They have lost huge, huge, huge amounts of money, much of which they will never get back. The commissioner, Don Garber, has put the number at $1 billion with a B, $1 billion in losses, because it's not only the fans not coming to the stadiums, it's also sponsorship money, it's concessions, it's parking, and TV money. So far, up until right now, they've played two games on television. A lot of their money comes from TV contracts, but they have been under the guidance of medical. They have huge medical teams. These have been ongoing talks that have been going on since March, since the league shut down. They have been talking to infectious disease doctors, medical people, health officials. This is all done in conjunction with health officials who have given them permission to hold this tournament. Otherwise, this tournament would not be going on. If it doesn't work, I guarantee you they'll shut it down immediately.
That was the Miami Herald's Michelle Kaufman. Again, Inter-Miami plays Orlando City tomorrow night on ESPN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial and let us know your expectations for the season. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. No show tomorrow because of a special school board meeting. We'll be back with another live show on Thursday.